Very nice to be with you. As Glenn mentioned when he was introducing me, about 30 years ago, I started a program called the Zen Hospice Project. It was the first Buddhist hospice in America. And we didn't have a clue what we were doing. We had no plan. It was a kind of fusion of spiritual insight and practical social action. We thought there was a natural match between people who were cultivating what we might call the listening heart or the listening mind in meditation and people who needed to be heard at least once in their lives, people who were dying. Beyond that, we didn't have much of a plan. But 30 years later, it's still here. I retired from that in 2005 to start another organization called the Metta Institute, which I created with Ram Dass and Norman Fisher, the former abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, and Rachel Naomi Remen, and Francis Vaughan, one of the pioneers of transpersonal psychology, and wonderful people, Angie Stevens, who with Trey Wilbur and Ken Wilbur started the first cancer support communities in America. And we set about training people based on what we'd learned at the bedside at Zen Hospice Project. Now, my dear bride, a few years ago, finally persuaded me to write a book. I avoided it like the plague for a lot of years. But she insisted that I wouldn't have to write it and that we could find a ghostwriter. That did not work out at all. But still, I'm glad she said she convinced me to do this. So I thought what I would do tonight, in lieu of a traditional Dharma talk, is I would read some passages, or maybe tell some stories, and then, but what I'd like to do is interact with you. So what I'd like to do is to read some things and then see how it's landing for you. I want to know what the effect is on you. So we'll have a little bit of a dialogue. And we've got some microphones, don't we, Glenn, somewhere? So if you want to respond to something or say something, then just raise your hand and I'll get to you and we'll get your microphone, so that way it'll get on the recording. So how about if I just start at the beginning and read you a little bit from the intro, and then we'll see where that takes us. So you like stories? Yeah, I do too. So here's how the book begins. Life and death are a package deal. You can't pull them apart. In Japanese Zen, there's a term, shoji, and it translates as birth, death. And there's no separation between life and death other than a small hyphen, a thin line that connects the two. We can't be truly alive without maintaining an awareness of death. And death is not waiting for us at the end of a long road. Death is always with us, in the marrow of every passing moment. She is the secret teacher, hiding in plain sight. She helps us to discover what matters most. And the good news is, we don't have to wait until the end of our lives to realize the wisdom that death has to offer. Over the past 30 years, I've sat on the precipice of death with a few thousand people. Some of them came to their deaths full of disappointment. Others blossomed and stepped through that door full of wonder. What made the difference was the willingness to gradually live into the deeper dimensions of what it means to be human. To imagine at the time of our death, we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime is an absurd gamble. This book is an invitation, five invitations actually, to sit down with death, to have a cup of tea with her, to let her guide you toward living a more meaningful and loving life. Without a reminder of death, we tend to take life for granted, often becoming lost in endless pursuits of self-gratification. When we keep death at our fingertips, It reminds us not to hold on to life so tightly. Maybe we take ourselves and our ideas a little less seriously. We let go a little more easily. We recognize that death comes to everyone, and so we appreciate that we are in the boat together. And this helps us to become a bit kinder and gentler with one another. As we come into contact with life's precarious nature, we also come to appreciate its preciousness. And then we don't want to waste a minute. We want to enter our lives fully and use them in a responsible way. Death is a good companion on the road to living well and dying without regret. I'm not romantic about dying. It's the hard work, maybe the hardest work we'll ever do in this life. It doesn't turn out well. It can be sad and cruel and messy and beautiful and mysterious. But most of all, it's normal. We all go through it. None of us get out of here alive. So let me just pause here for a second. I want to see how that's landing for you. What's just even these first few paragraphs? How's it landing? What's happening for you? You don't have to have a commentary on the book. You're welcome to, but I more want to know what's happening for you. What's happening in your body? What do you notice happening? What are the honest feelings in your heart? What's happening in your mind? Is it comparing, judging, remembering? What's happening? Anybody willing to say? Raise your hand. We'll get you a mic right here in the second row in the front. Whoever's got the mics, there we go.
So I've always been very afraid of death, of dying. I'm a nurse of 26 years and shied away from working in oncology. And as you said this, I was in awe. I was awestruck with the beauty of life and the invitation to live every minute. I mean, that is just so joyful. Thank you.
Anybody else? Well, I just want to know how it's landing for you. Helps me to know what to do next. Yeah, I'll be here in the front row then. Right here in the very front. Yeah.
Well, I am shaking my head. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it's good to hear the words that kind of go along with how I feel about it. And I think my life has led me to, you know, assert at least maybe the feelings, maybe not the words, because I don't know your words as well as you do, but the feelings just
resonate with me. It resonates for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a guy, you know, the guy who's, John, I think is, I want to say Underwood, he started the Death Cafe movement, you know, that's out there. And he said, we have left this conversation to doctors and nurses and undertakers. And so we have put it off and absented ourselves from the conversation. Time for the conversation is now, not at the end of our life. Somebody over there. Yeah.
So I think it's quite amazing that about death. You know, I've been a Marine for a while, but I realize there's two things that you start as soon as you're born, and one is dying, and the other is life's journey.
Yeah,
so
living.
It's just pretty nice that that's the first two things that you do.
Shoji, birth and death, life and death. It's actually one word, life, death, and a small hyphen. All right, let me read you just a few paragraphs more, and then we'll see. Some of the people I worked with, like they do at Joseph's house, lived in terrible conditions. In rat-infested hotels or on park benches behind City Hall, they were alcoholics and prostitutes, homeless folks who barely survived on the margins of society. Often they wore the face of resignation or were angry about their loss of control. Many had lost all trust in humanity. I changed a lot of diapers on park benches behind City Hall. We helped teach desk clerks and prostitutes how to care for the people that lived in the single-room occupancy hotels that they lived in. Some were from cultures I did not know, speaking languages I could not understand. Some had a deep faith that carried them through difficult times, while others had sworn off religion years ago. Niuen feared ghosts. His roommate Isaiah was comforted by visits from his dead mother. There was a hemophiliac father who'd contracted the HIV virus from a blood transfusion. But a year or so before his illness, he disowned his gay son. But now, at the end of life, father and son were both dying of AIDS, lying next to each other in twin beds in a shared bedroom, being cared for by Agnes, the father's wife, and the son's mother. Many people I worked with died in their early 20s, having hardly begun their lives. But there was a woman I cared for named Elizabeth who at 93 asked, "Why has death come for me so soon?" Some were clear as bells, whereas others couldn't recall their own names. Some were surrounded by the love of family and friends. Others were entirely alone. Alex, without the support of loved ones, became so confused from his AIDS dementia that he climbed out onto the fire escape one night and froze to death. We cared for cops and firefighters who saved numerous lives, nurses who attended the pain and breathlessness of others, doctors who had pronounced patients dead from the same illnesses that now were ravaging their own bodies. People with political power, acquired wealth, and good health insurance, and refugees with little more than the shirts on their backs. For some, dying was a great gift. They made reconciliations with their long-lost families, freely expressed their love and forgiveness, or they found the kindness and acceptance they'd been looking for their whole lives. And still others turned toward the wall in withdrawal and hopelessness, and never came back again. All of them were my teachers. These people invited me into the most vulnerable moments, and it made it possible for me to get up close and personal with death. And in the process, they taught me how to live. In Zen, we say, it's good to have your teacher in the room with you. And these people are my teachers, and they've been with me these 30 years. Dying is inevitable and intimate. I've seen ordinary people at the end of their lives develop profound insights and engage in a powerful process of transformation that helped them to emerge as something larger and more expansive and more real than the small, separate selves they had previously taken themselves to be. This is not a fairy tale, happy ending that contradicts the suffering that came before, but rather a transcendence of tragedy. The discovery of this capacity regularly occurs for many people in the final months, days, or even moments of life. Too late, you might say, and I might agree. However, the value is not in how long they enjoyed the experience, but that the possibility that such transformation exists at all. And if it exists then, it exists now. I wrote the five invitations on the back of a cocktail napkin 30,000 feet over Kansas. I was being asked by Bill Moyers, who was a friend, to come back and meet with many other wonderful experts in the country to prepare a film that Bill was doing on dying in America called On Our Own Terms. And so he asked each of us to come back and give talks and such. And so I was on a panel with some wonderful silver-tongued devils that you would know. And I prepared a very salient talk. And as we went down the panel, they just talked on and on and on. And so by the time it got to me, there was no time left. And they said, "Sorry, our time is up." And that was it. So Bill pulled me aside. He said, "Frank, could you just say a few simple things?" Just a few simple things that would speak to the heart of this work. So I pulled out my cocktail napkin. And on it I'd written, "Don't wait. Welcome everything, push away nothing. Find a place of rest in the middle of things. Bring your whole self to the experience. And cultivate don't know mind." Those have been my guidelines for working with people who are dying for several decades now. But it turns out they have a relevance for the rest of us in living a life of integrity. Yeah. So let me check in with you again. How are you doing? What's happening? How's your heart? How's your mind? Let's go over here to this person over here.
I've read a book, maybe a precursor to yours, called A Year to Live, you know, a very popular, famous book. Mm-hmm. It was a while ago that I read it. But I find it very difficult, even though I know rationally I'm going to die just like everybody else, I find it very difficult to have it become something other than an abstraction.
Yeah.
And I have actually witnessed, not like you, but uh-huh. a few family members in yeah. their final days. So it's not as though I haven't seen it.
Right.
So did it
right.
take many experiences for you to have it become more real for yourself?
Well, it took me having a heart attack for it to become really real. But, you know, the other night I was speaking to a group of Silicon Valley folks, and I was reading to them, and the guy said, "I'm not so sure death is inevitable." He said, "We're working on it, you know." So I said, "Well, don't think about it, death, as this thing that happens at the end of a long road or at the end of a long-term illness. Think about it as right here, right now." You know, we think of death as something later, and that gives us a comfortable distance from it. Later. Later, when we get old, right? It's interesting. We think of this as an ever-changing world. Seasons come and go, right? Where is this morning's breakfast? Where is last night's lovemaking? Where, in heaven's name, has my blonde hair gone to? So when I think of death as constant change, it's interesting to me that we can imagine that everything changes, or we can appreciate this, and we say everything changes except me, right? It's all changing except me. I'm the one solid thing moving through an ever-changing universe. Right? That's how we do it. That's the illusion we live with. That's the abstraction. That we don't see clearly, truthfully, actually what's happening. We think it's going to happen later instead of the reality that is happening right now. Okay, what else is on your hearts and minds? Yeah, this gentleman here, right there, yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
My heart is kind of, it's like, I have this like fuzzy, like bubbly feeling in my heart,
uh-huh.
and it's very hopeful,
uh-huh.
and my mind is going, my mom works in, or spends a lot of time in hospice, and I want to buy her this book. It's beautiful, and yeah, I get a lot of hope from what you're saying, and I'm reminded of a prayer that I recite. Oftentimes when I'm experiencing pain or challenges or darkness and it ends, it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. And that's brought me a lot of hope in the way I feel and think about death and change.
Uh-huh.
Change is something that terrifies me.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy what you have to say.
Yeah, thank you. There's a passage later in the book, I don't know if we'll get to it, but I say change is inevitable, but change does not guarantee transformation. Change will just keep happening, but we won't necessarily be transformed by it unless we turn toward it and not just embrace it, but really come to know it intimately. Yeah. The first precept is don't wait. Don't wait. Waiting is full of expectation. Waiting for the next moment to arrive, we miss this one. I cannot tell you how many times I've been with people who are families whose loved one is dying, and they'd say, when is mom going to die? And waiting for the moment of death, we missed all the moments in between. Don't wait to tell someone you love that you love them. Don't wait to make death a friend. George Harrison told us the truth when he sang, "All things must pass." Years ago, I'll just tell you this. Years ago, I had when my son was very young, 3 or 4 years old, we had a preschool. A friend of mine and I started. And we had 15 kids who were about that age, 3 to 5 years old. And what we would do is we had a game one day, and it was we'd take them into the nearby woods and say, let's find dead things. Yeah. And so the kids were very excited about this. They were really curious about this. They loved it, you know. And they'd go and find all kinds of dead things, you know. And then we'd put them all out on a blue tarp under the fir trees, and we'd have a kind of show and tell. And they were amazing and curious and imaginative. Like, you know, they would find a piece of bark and say, oh, this had been a blanket for a mouse during the winter, but it didn't need it anymore now in the spring. Or a rusty old car part, you know, they would describe as something that had fallen from a spaceship that was passing over. Yeah. Or one little girl I remember said, I think the leaves that fall from the trees are very generous. They're very kind. They make room for all the new leaves to grow. If not, there would be no room for those leaves. We count on impermanence. Because of impermanence, life exists. That boring dinner party you went to will come to an end. Yeah? Evil dictatorships will fall. Even trees burn to make room for new ones. Yeah. The second invitation is welcome everything, push away nothing. Now that sounds great, right? It'd make a good bumper sticker. How do you do that? Welcome everything, push away nothing. My dear bride, Vanda, she's from England. And when she came to America, they don't have this word welcome so much. They don't use the word welcome so much in England. They say, in regards to thank you, they'll say something like, no bother at all, or no trouble at all. And so I had to teach her about welcome. She said, well, what does it mean, welcome? I said, it means this. This is what welcome means, everything. In welcoming everything, it doesn't mean that you have to approve of what's arising. You don't have to, it's not about approving or disapproving. The word welcome confronts us to temporarily suspend our usual rush to judgment and to simply be open to what's happening, to receive it in the spirit of hospitality. A friend of mine was once invited to a dinner at the home of a renowned psychiatrist named Sidney. And Sidney was a man of unusual intelligence and insight and grace. However, in the past few years prior to this dinner, his Alzheimer's disease had taken toll of his short-term memory and his ability to recognize faces. When my friend arrived, she rang the doorbell, and Sidney opened the door And at first, he had a look of confusion. He quickly recovered and said, "I'm sorry. I have trouble remembering faces these days, but I do know that this is our home, and that our home has always been a place where guests were welcome. So if you are here on my doorstep, then it is my job to welcome you. Please come in." Welcoming everything can't be done as an act of will. It can only be done as an act of love. My daughter Gina and I like to shop in consignment stores for vintage clothing. There are great finds in such shops, a silk paisley scarf, a retro leather jacket, a pair of sequined heels. While Gina tries on outfits, I peruse the other racks for the next cool item. Many of the clothes have small stains or a missing button or a tear in the fabric. And I noticed in one store that all the clothes carried a cardboard tag with the price and a disclaimer that said, "As is." I like these tags. I think we should get them for ourselves and each other. I can't imagine a greater gift we could offer ourselves or each other. Welcome everything and push away nothing is neither foolish nor an idealistic invitation. On the contrary, it is eminently practical. Accepting life as is means that we make peace with things as they are, rather than trying to force them to be the way we want them to be and getting frustrated that we can't, and instead of spinning a story that we then try and live into, we open to the way things are and accept that we are completely human. To be human is more than being born and getting an education and finding the right partner and getting a pretty house on a nice street just so that you can sleep, wake, work, go to bed, and do it all over again. It's an invitation to feel everything, to come into direct contact with this strange, beautiful, horrible, and often perfectly ordinary thing we call life. It's an opportunity to make conscious of the fact that some of us will make love while others make war, to recognize the truth that there are babies, like my granddaughter, born into loving arms, caressed by a mother who kisses the bright future into her child's cheeks. And there are babies like Carolyn, a woman I knew whose parents left her in a dumpster. To embrace the night screams in refugee camps and the giggling of children in living rooms under tents made of couch pillows and bed sheets. There is devastation and hopelessness, and there is passion and the holy commitment to creating a better future for everyone. There is me writing and you reading and the separation between us, and there is the unity we feel almost immediately when we are reminded that there is love. Great African-American writer, James Baldwin, beautiful, great man, you know. There's a beautiful film out about him now that I want to recommend you see, I Am Not Your Negro. And he says, Baldwin says, not everything we face can be changed, but nothing can be changed unless it's faced. That's welcome everything, push away nothing. Yeah. How you doing? What's on your hearts and minds now? How is this landing for you? Welcome everything, push away nothing? Huh. Anybody want to speak? Who's got the mic? Yeah.
When I get sick, I really get cranky.
Yeah.
And I'm getting older now. I'm 68, you know, getting closer to things. And I hear stories, you know, you tell stories of how people die so well. And I'm afraid I'm not going to do it very well at all.
Yeah.
And I just feel that fear. And so I know I have to, you know, be with it, all the Buddhist things I need to do with it. And I love how you say as is, you know, this is how it's going to be. It's as is. Yet I still, you know, it's a real feeling of, you know, I don't know if I'm going to do it very well.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be very... I'm not going to be very nice to be around. I really hope that someone will be there for me.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Well, let her have the mic there. I just want to ask you a question, if I could. When you're afraid, do you know you're afraid?
Well, sometimes it's another emotion, but it might come down to that.
Yeah.
I may.
So, for example, when you think about your dying and you get afraid, do you know that you're afraid?
I may not recognize it right away, but yeah.
Yeah.
So
that part of you that knows you're afraid, mm-hmm. not afraid.
It's noticing.
It's aware that there's fear. And this is not a bypass. This is not some spiritual get around. It is to recognize that there is a part of us that is aware of our fear, that is not afraid. Mm-hmm. And we can function from that. We can orient to that. Or we can orient to the fear. It's not a fait accompli that you will be afraid when you're dying.
I could not identify with the fear, just identify with I am fear.
Yeah,
I am,
these are fancy words.
Yeah, yeah.
Just know that there's a part of you that sees that you're afraid, and that part's not afraid. Forget about identities and egos and all that stuff. Just see that. Just see that you can see that you're afraid. That means that there's some part of you can have a relationship with what's afraid. That some part of you can say, oh, I understand, you're scared. That's what's going on. Okay, come here. Come close. Come close to me. Let these boundaries come together. This part of you that's not afraid and the part that is. Don't try and chase away the fear. It's not necessary. Look, I said earlier I had a heart attack, you know. Now I'm Mr. Hospice, you know. Can you imagine the pressure on me to do this well? Here's the Zen Hospice guy, you know. Let's see how he does with it. Yeah. Not so well. It doesn't always turn out good, and that's okay. There was a young woman that I worked with. She was in her mid-30s. She was dying of a cancer. For about 3 days, she hadn't spoken. She hadn't taken a drink. She hadn't eaten anything. She hadn't opened her eyes. And her mother came to visit. Now, her mother and her had a terrible relationship. It was abusive, awful relationship. And her mother flew from the other side of the country to be at her bedside and sat down beside her daughter and poured out her heart and said, please forgive me. Please forgive me what I've done. And this young woman sat up in bed like a rocket. And she looked directly at her mother and she said, I hate you. I've always hated you. And then she died. There was a lot of suffering in that room. What's compassion? Compassion is the capacity to stay in the room when there's a lot of suffering. It doesn't take all the suffering away. It gives you the capacity to stay with the suffering. Now, most of us, and many of us in the room who went, oh, we're parents. And, you know, it was hard for that mom. I worked with her for 6 months afterwards. I know it was hard for her. But it was also something extraordinary that this young woman told the truth. Maybe a truth that she's been needing to tell her whole life. And that, actually, her telling that truth helped her mother. Helped her mother really see the consequences of her actions. Should I read a little more? whole book of stuff to read. One of the other precepts is bring your whole self to the experience. To bring your whole self doesn't mean that you're perfect. It means no parts left out. Matthew was a gay man and a longtime Buddhist practitioner, very well known actually. He was hospitalized with pneumonia related to his HIV diagnosis, and he was running a high fever, and he kept crying out and constantly writhing and wriggling in his bed. He wanted to crawl out of his skin. Matthew was also battling a kind of inner critic who in his case was dressed in the robes of spiritual authority. Matthew was a man who was raised by a fundamentalist Christian family. His father was a fire and brimstone preacher who literally beat the Bible into him. It's not uncommon when we come close to death that our long-buried cultural mores and early religious training suddenly resurface at the time of death, even if the person has deliberately left those beliefs behind. So I tried to support Matthew by orienting him to mindfulness and compassion practice like a good Buddhist, right? And they just bounced off him. He didn't care about Buddhist practice. You know, we had a tanka next to his bed, and we had a beautiful Buddha next to his bed. I remember meditating, doing metta practice with him, playing chants in the room. Nothing helped. And finally, about 3 a.m, I got so tired, I decided to go home. So I went home, drove my car. And on the way home, I remembered, for some reason, my first Holy Communion. And so I went to my closet when I got home, and I dug through all the storage boxes and came to my memory box. And there was in my memory box a little 3-inch plastic statue of Jesus with the lambs and the little children around him. So I dug it out, and I went back to the hospital, and I took away the Buddha statue, and I took away the tanka, and I took away all the chant music, and I made a small altar and put this little 3-inch plastic Jesus on the altar. And I was just smoothing out the altar cloth when the cleaning woman came in the room, Deanna. And she walked in the room. She said, "Merciful Jesus. When merciful Jesus is here, it's all okay." Just like that. And John looked up and met eye to eye with Deanna. And I thought, I don't need to be here anymore. They're going to work it out. And I left. And in the morning I came back and John was sitting up in bed eating Jell-O, you know. The same image had been transformed, do you understand? The punishing God had been transformed into the merciful God. Yeah. One of the ways that we practice in this tradition is with attention to the breath. I mentioned a while ago that I had a heart attack and I had an urgent, I was teaching a workshop on compassion for a group of doctors and nurses. and actually, I didn't have a heart attack in the workshop. I had heart pain, really bad heart pain, and I completely denied it 3 times. Like, Peter and Christ. Yeah. The last time I was in a video conference with Ram Dass, and Ram Dass is an old friend and I love him dearly, and I found myself getting kind of irritable with him. I was in pain, and I was irritable with my friend, and it reminded me of my wife when she was giving birth to my son. And I would try and say helpful things, and she'd just growl at me, you know. So I thought, something's wrong. And I said, "Ram Dass, I have to go now. You keep going." And I left, and they took me to the hospital, and I had a heart attack in the emergency room. Anyway, there's triple bypass surgery, big deal, 12 hours of surgery, and I'm in the CCU recovery unit, you know. And let me read you about that. After 6 hours of a triple bypass surgery, nurses wheeled me into the coronary care unit. This high-tech zone was straight out of a sci-fi movie, replete with multiple electronic monitors and incessant sound of beeping. My heartbeat was tracked on wires attached to pads on my chest. Clot-busting medications dripped stealthily into the veins in one arm while morphine flowed into the other. A catheter traveled up to my bladder, and another plastic tube drained fluids from my neck. And a long intubation tube connected my lungs to a ventilator that was breathing for me. All the while, the staff bustled about. So you have to imagine the scene. I can't speak. I'm coming out of this morphine, this anesthesia fog. And into the room walks a respiratory therapist who says, "Let's pull out those tubes and see if you can breathe." That's how he introduced himself. And I waved my arms. No, no, no. I could feel there was something wrong with my lung. And I got the notepad and I wrote, "I'm scared." Next to my bed on one side was my son, and on the other side was my dear friend Eugene Cash. He's a wonderful meditation teacher. Some of you know Eugene. And he's a very smart, no-nonsense guy. And so he instructed me to sense my body. But I couldn't feel anything above my knees. "You're worried about what's going to happen when you die?" And then he said, "Frank, find your breath." But I couldn't find my breath. I couldn't tell what was my breath and what was the machine breathing for me. No? Don't count on the fact that your breath is going to be the thing that's going to be, you're going to be able to count on your dying. Don't tell yourself that story. And in this moment, I remembered one of my other great teachers who I never met, Suzuki Roshi. And you know, Suzuki Roshi, the great Zen master who turned the wheel of Dharma in 10 short years in America, changed the whole face of Dharma. The night before he was dying, he wanted to take a bath, and his wife, Oka-san, said, "No, no, no." But he insisted, and so his son, Otohiro, Otohiro went in and picked up his father. And he brought him to the bath. And he lowered Suzuki Roshi into the warm bath water. And as he did this, Suzuki Roshi became terrified. He was afraid he would drown. So in the hospital, I thought, if Suzuki Roshi can be scared, I can be scared. So I grabbed Eugene by the shirt and I pulled him close to me. And somehow he understood. And I put my ear right next to his cheek and he would breathe. And so I couldn't find my own breath, but I could follow his rhythm. I followed the rhythm of his breath. I borrowed his breath until I could find my own. And then I waved to the man to take out the tube, you know. And my son put his hand on my chest and it was like a conduit from God. With love and breath, I found my way home. Let's go eat and get you a microphone, okay?
So what happens when loving, smart people aren't around? My dearest friend died now about 3 years ago, and I was doing hospice volunteer work, and a group of us formed a core to help her. We had always known her as a spiritual person, and yet in her dying, we described her death as a terrible death.
You did, huh?
Because although she had always been described as spiritual, she was so petrified. And I came in on one of her last days, and she insisted that there was a video that had all of the prescriptions that would make her better. And if people were not helping her find that prescription.
Yeah.
And so I was with her, and I talked with her about, could this be a dream, and her wish. But the fear didn't go away. And we weren't smart enough, even though I thought I had all these hospice skills. And I just had an argument the other day with another friend who insisted that my friend couldn't have been spiritual or she wouldn't have been that afraid.
Well, I can tell you I've taken care of some of the leading Buddhist teachers in America. Almost all of them were scared. If Suzuki Roshi can be scared, I can be scared. Didn't define who he was.
You need to be around people.
Yes, you know, we talk a lot about karma, which is a vastly misunderstood idea. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there's something called proximate karma. And it basically means what's in the neighborhood. Yeah? Proximate karma. So even if we are confused and lost and stuff, if there's good people in the neighborhood, it helps us. Go to Joseph's house. People are frightened all the time, but there's good people in the neighborhood. There's caregivers and staff there who are a calm presence. You know, when you're a nurse, you move, you lend the patient your arms and legs and move them from the bed to the commode. But we can lend people the stability of our minds also. We can open our hearts in such a way that it might inspire them to open theirs. But it's also okay to be with them as is. Yeah? As is. In Buddhism, we speak about wisdom and compassion as the two wings of the bird that have to be in balance. You know, otherwise we keep flying in circles. Wisdom, the wisdom that gives rise to compassion is the wisdom of non-separation, the wisdom that we are tangled up together. There's two facets of wisdom. One we could say, assuming two facets of compassion, one we could say is universal compassion, absolute compassion. That is, that everybody and everything has always been embraced by compassion, even if they didn't know it. And then there's relative compassion, or everyday compassion. And that's when we do stuff. And we change soiled linens, or we feed a homeless person, or we stand up against injustice. Now, relative compassion gets exhausting. It's hard work. And we want people to thank us for our good acts, you know? So relative compassion has to be grounded, sourced in absolute compassion and universal compassion. Otherwise, we burn out. But universal compassion is just a big idea. It's just a big notion. Unless it's grounded in relative everyday compassion. In other words, it needs our arms and legs. It needs our eyes and tongues. That's how it manifests in the world. I mean, if prayers were enough to stop all the suffering of the world, we would have stopped it a long time ago. But it's not enough. We have to stand. My friend Bernie Glassman, he's a wonderful Zen teacher. He was in Germany a few years ago, and he was teaching about Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is a Tibetan manifestation of a Buddha that is the embodiment of compassion. Female deity, we call her. And she, you've seen statues of these, you know, in the Cost Plus store or something, you know. She has 1,000 arms. 1,000 arms. And in each hand, there is an ear to hear the cries of the world, and 1,000 arms to respond. Yeah? So Bernie was talking about this in Germany, and the man raised his hand, as you did, and said, "I'm sorry, but I only have 2 arms. What should I do?" And Bernie said, I'm sorry, you're mistaken. And the man said, no, I'm quite sure. I have only two arms. And Bernie said, I'm sorry, you're wrong. And then Bernie had everybody in the room raise both their arms. Go ahead, do it. Look around. Look around. Turn around and see. 1,000 arms. We can't do this alone. And we are not alone in this life. I think that's enough. I'm going to remind you that on Saturday, I'll teach all day here at the church in Rockville? Thank you, Rockville. I'll get there. Somebody will bring me there. And please come and join us. In fact, tonight, if you want to register, Scott will be back in the tea room there with a computer, and you can register tonight. So do that if you could. All of the money, everything, including my Donna, will go to Joseph's house. So please come and support Joseph's house. Now, the second thing is to remind you that I have a book back there called Five Invitations. And you just heard some of it. So if you're interested in it, you can buy it tonight. I think maybe some of it supports the community here. But also, it makes a nice gift to give to people who are struggling with these issues. So I want to thank you very, very much. I appreciate it. And my deep, deep respect and gratitude to Tara for her invitation and for all that she does in the world. Thank you, Tara, for getting born and for bringing so much truth and love and beauty into our world. Thank you.